This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB FM in Carmel, California.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's June 23rd, 1975, and this is Dialogue Conspiracy number 201. I received a book when I came in the studio today, The Permanent War Economy by Seymour Millman. I appreciate very much the person who sent it to me. There's no return address to thank, and I assume this is a regular weekly listener, and I thank that person. The same person sent me the Philip Agee book, Inside the Company, on the CIA. I love these kind of listeners. If you have books that you think I should have, if you pick them up at used bookstores or new bookstores, that's fine, because I can't possibly afford all the books I should have in my library. They're coming out so quickly now. So thank you for The Permanent War Economy by Seymour Millman. I also received at the post office when I came into Carmel the manuscript, a published paperback book by Frank Salant called Who Shot George Wallace? This book is available. You can order these from Mr. Frank Salant. He spoke at the conference in Boston, the Conspiracy Conference, and you can write to me at KLRB for his address, or you can write to him for this document. His address is 48 Parker Boulevard, Monsey, New York, M-O-N-S-E-Y, New York, 10952. I believe he's asking $5 or $6 for this book. I like the way Mr. Salant is putting his information together. He wrote me a letter recently saying that I had been a big influence in his life, the way that I wrote my articles for The Realist, and he thanked me for the leads and the information which I had given to him on the Wallace case or other assassination cases. And he followed somewhat the format which I put into my articles, which I think makes it clearer in the long run. And I wish that other researchers would pick up the format and write books in the same way that I'm doing that. Not that my style is so great, but we're not trying to sell a slick story, such as the Watergate story, All the President's Men, that isn't put into an outline that you can't use as a research project. What Mr. Salant did was he wrote his book into 12 sections. He has an introduction. Then he has Witnesses Not Called, another one called The Other Conspirators. Section 4 is How Many Bullets, How Many Gunmen. 5 is Evidence Planted and Forged. 6, The Suspect's Escape. 7 is Coincidence. 8, White House Involvement. 9, FBI Errors. 10, Witnesses Dead or Missing. 11, Motive, Why Was Wallace Shot? And 12 is called Forgive My Grief. Now, if more researchers would get together in the way that Mr. Salant has done and I have done, and we take these various conspiracies and have sections on evidence that was destroyed or planted or forged, or how many bullets in each case, witnesses to call. These are the listings that I started with based upon my 11 years of research into the political conspiracies. We could combine our chapters together. For example, the influence of books read by these people, the diaries or alleged writings that they kept, the police errors, the FBI errors, the collusion of the Justice Department, the collusion of the judges and the courts. And if we took one outline of this kind of work and broke each of the conspiracies down, we could combine them to books alone just on coincidences or books on White House involvement in each conspiracy. So I am very impressed with the book by Mr. Salant. It's only a short document. The one that he's put out and copyrighted is only about 20 pages, but it puts the writing into categories where you get the information. If you want to know how many bullets, you go right to that section, and it doesn't have a long narrative, and it looks like an excellent document. The front page of the San Francisco Chronicle has a copyrighted story today on the Marine shootout in California. It says, the front page headline is, Nationwide Plot is Hinted. The Marin shootout is the killings that took place in Marin County August 7th, 1970, in which Judge Harold Haley was murdered and 3 other men were murdered. And it was alleged prison escape. Jonathan Jackson, the brother George Jackson, was killed. Judge Haley was there, and James McLean was killed. This article has a picture of Lewis Tackwood, the agent provocateur, who I've spoken about many times. I refer to his book, The Glass House Tapes, and he's been on KLRB with me on Dialogue Conspiracy. And it goes into the fact, it says, now 5 years later, the San Francisco Chronicle has learned that the shootout was the result of a grandiose nationwide plot. During the course of a 12-week investigation, they said a massive blunder allowed the shootout to occur. They called it a blunder, and I think it was purposeful. The Los Angeles Police Department had agents on the scene of the crime. Lewis Tackwood was there and told to go home that day. They had foreknowledge. And this is what I mean by police collusion. They knew weeks in advance that there was going to be an escape plan. But I believe the police department not only assisted it, but evidence will show that a gun from the police department fired some fatal bullets at the shootout. But this article is, I'm not going to dwell on it at length today because I want to go into other important matters. But there's several points I want to make. In the Realist article that I did in 1973, July 73, I briefly made the first links of the CIA to prison riots, prison conspiracies, the Los Angeles Police Department, and the violences such as the Attica, the shootout, the shooting of George Jackson, and the killing of Judge Haley. There are links of the CIA, the FBI, the criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department that are interlocked and linked also to the killing of Robert Kennedy and to the major political assassinations. The framework of each of these grand conspiracies, which is national, has a structure identical to the other conspiracy. So the headline today is Nationwide Plot Hinted. Now, one matter is that there was evidence, a document, that was discarded by an attorney working with Angela Davis, who was accused of being part of the mastermind of this plot and was later acquitted. And this note of her lawyer's was found on the floor of a prison. It was discarded, and the cook found it. And Superior Court Judge Richard Arnonson of Contra Costa County ordered that this be copied and sealed and sworn to silence, and that nobody could say what these notes were. And these notes were documents that linked two law enforcement agencies to the shootout, specifically the Los Angeles Police Department and the State Bureau of Investigation. This document showed the judge that they Police Department and the Bureau of Investigation knew in advance that there was going to be a shootout. Now, just before the shootout, Angela Davis and George Jackson had been corresponding, meeting each other, visits at prisons, and these people were together frequently. So the visiting could have been called off prior to this shootout. Lives could have been saved. The judge's life could have been saved. But by sacrificing Judge Haley, which is what Lewis Tackwood said they did, that the Los Angeles Police Department said he was too liberal, they had an excuse to begin the armed courts with the skin searches and the glass partitions and taking fingerprints and IDs and so forth. And the courtrooms became armed camps, and they still are. So after these violent shootouts, you get more laws of control, more police state. And the police allow these to happen, and they plan them to happen. As I say, there's a picture of Lewis Tackwood in the paper today, and the documents that have been locked up for 5 years show the involvement of the police department. The reason these are coming out now is that the San Quentin six men that were charged with killings at the time George Jackson was murdered, have a trial going on, and Mr. Frank Cox, a deputy public defender for one of the defendants, has alleged that there was a conspiracy that involved the Los Angeles Police Department, that his client was not responsible for that shootout or the violence that pursued. We'll do more on that later, but I have written about it in The Realist, and it is current. Another news report that came over last week has to do with Ted Chirac, a man that I respect tremendously as a researcher, who's been put down by other researchers who ignore him. His evidence is massive of a second gun in the Ambassador Hotel. He produced the movie, The Second Gun, and Chirac has not been going to a lot of these conferences. He wasn't invited to UCLA. There's certain people that I accuse on the air and privately and publicly of wanting a low conspiracy level and not put the blame where it should be, and these very people ignore Ted Chirac or ridicule him. The subject came up in Los Angeles at the last conference in May, whereas Ted Chirac And some smart aleck was saying, oh, he's going around the country looking for that second gun. Well, now the news this week is Chirac has, after 7 years, gone around the country, and he had good clues, and he claims now that he has the other gun that shot Robert Kennedy from the back of the head that was fired in the Ambassador Hotel. There was a .22 caliber pistol, almost identical to Sirhan's, that was owned by a security guard standing directly behind Senator Kennedy when he was shot. That security guard's name is Thane Caesar, who was sent from Lockheed to protect Robert Kennedy. The allegations are that it was his weapon that fired the fatal shots, and the story was that his gun was stolen and was not available for ballistic tests. Well, Chirac traced that gun, and he thinks he's located inmates in Arkansas and Missouri who've admitted that they have the weapon, and he's negotiating with them, and he will give a ballistic test. And if that pistol is right, the serial number is V1332, and if it's recovered and tested, it will solve the story of who killed Robert Kennedy. It won't solve the question that researchers like myself and Ted Chirac and Sherman Skolnick and others have done, who concealed the evidence, who in the Justice Department, the Police Department, the judges, the attorneys for the prosecution, the attorneys for the defense, have all worked in these giant conspiracies along with organized crime and the syndicate in every one of these murders and assassinations. Those are the things we have to unravel. But the controversy of the actual shooting would be solved. Ted Chirac has a number in Los Angeles to reach if news people are interested. You can write me a letter and send a self-addressed envelope, and I'll give it to you. But he claims that after traveling and working, he has located this gun. I did promise several weeks ago that we'd do a 10-part continuous series on Gerald Ford's book, The Portrait of the Assassin, because CBS is going to make a movie in the fall. The news is coming in so fast on murders and assassinations that I find that each week I have to put, or last week I put off the discussion or analysis of Gerald Ford's book to go into the Rockefeller Committee findings on the CIA. And today I'm just briefly going to make a few comments about this particular document that's being made, the documentary. It's going to be made at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and I have a few notes about it and a few feelings about it. That book, The Portrait of the Assassin by Gerald Ford, was put together while he was a congressman. It was sold at a personal profit. It was put out for propaganda purposes. At his confirmation hearing, Gerald Ford said he didn't use classified documents, but it's been called attention to by Mark Lane and others that the documents that he used in his book are still marked top secret, and that he did publish a book using top secret documents. Only difference between him and Daniel Ellsberg, Mark Lane says, is that one got charged with treason and the other became president of the United States. No member of the Warren Commission was supposed to write a book, and Gerald Ford's role was to perpetuate, through a form of mind control, the story that Oswald was the deranged madman. It was Gerald Ford who linked the stories of Oswald's diary to Life magazine. I've talked about that on Dialogue Conspiracy. And the links of Gerald Ford with Richard Nixon and E. Howard Hunt that were very thick through CIA days. And I think that it's important to take note about who is making this movie for what it is worth. I have a few feelings about it. MGM is the studio that's making the movie. In the heat of Watergate, Hank Haldeman, the son of H.R. Haldeman, was sent to MGM for a summer job. But more important than Haldeman was a man who completely got off any investigations, and his name should be known, and people can do some work looking into this person. His name is Ken Reitz, R-E-I-T-Z, and he was a member of the super, super secret team at CREEP, the Committee to Reelect the President, and the White House. The Committee to Reelect the President was run by Maurice Stans. They hired G. Gordon Liddy and James McCord, and they had a tremendous amount of millions of dollars coming in for espionage activity, which was separated from Republican fundraising money. But in addition to the Committee to Reelect the President, there was another super, super secret fund, more secret than CREEP, and it was run also by Mr. Jeb Magruder and Maurice Stans and G. Gordon Liddy. And Ken Reitz was part of a secret bank account on the directions of Hugh Sloan. This bank account had nothing to do with Creep, or it was a fringe off of Creep. Ken Reitz is 31 years old, and he allegedly headed what they called Nixon's youth campaign. Now, the money from this secret account was kept in a special bank in Maryland, in Bethesda, Maryland, and it involved Henry Buchanan, the brother of Patrick Buchanan, the speechwriter for Nixon, who's still a well-known columnist, and it was set up outside of regular bank account channels on the direction of Hugh Sloan. The office, as I say, was in Bethesda, Maryland, away from Creep, and the excuse for these secret funds that there is jealousies within the organizations. Now, Maurice Stans knew the bank account, but he kept it very quiet during the Watergate investigations, and nothing came out of it. The Washington Post, April 26, 1973, an article by Lou Cannon, referred to Ken Reitz's operation as many little Watergates, all locked up into this special little bank. And now Ken Reitz is out at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and that's where Gerald Ford's book is being made. So it's just, I wonder how much money that was used to go into covering up, say, the Watergate affair, or for using clandestine operations for sabotage in this country and possible violence at the conventions, or even money for the Wallace shooting, which hasn't been accounted for. How much money out of this particular little bank account went for spy work for special group? Ken Reitz's job was to spy on radical groups. His friends, particularly one by the name of George Gordon, said that his material was too hot to handle, that he was too hot to handle. They were going to put him in the State Department. Reitz was moved to the Department of Interior, to the Bicentennial Commission, and now he's at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. So it would be interesting to know if the four-hour movie on Portrait of the Assassin by Gerald Ford is being handled by any of the money coming through any person like Ken Reitz or this private bank account in Maryland. If this is a CIA funding operation that looks like a project of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, but is a special movie, and the purpose of it, of course, is to continue the lie Lee Harvey Oswald was both deranged and that he was an assassin. And that was Gerald Ford's role, and it's being made at Metro. And again, hopefully next week I want to go into some more of Gerald Ford's actual book and the documentation. But I did want to talk about something that was on the news tonight, and it's been on the news all week, the links of the CIA and the syndicate to organized crime, and then, of course, the murder of Sam Giancana this week. Last week on Dialogue Conspiracy, I spoke about the attempt to make a low-level investigation of the JFK assassination that I thought Bernard Fensterwald and Mark Lane and persons in Congress would settle for a hired hitman operation, because Fensterwald is James McCord's attorney, since he was during the Watergate arrest, and he has been linked with the CIA himself. The CIA announced this week officially that they had destroyed the links of James McCord to the CIA, and the problem that we're getting now is that the mafia heads or head could be murdered, and then it's easy to put the blame on them. When they get rid of Sam Giancana, then the message passes to other people, and the high-level CIA plan of the assassination of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King can be kept at a very low level if these top bosses are murdered. I predicted that there would be a bloody battle between the used CIA links of government, and they are beginning to start. Hughes and CIA are one in my mind, and Giancana was wiped out before he could testify about the links of the Hughes to the CIA. Wiping this man out eliminates a lot of the information that he would know. Now, the mafia is perfectly aware of this struggle for international drug traffic, because this is what it's about, really. The Drug Enforcement Agency, it's formed by Richard Nixon in 73. It's somewhat of a legal takeover of American drug traffic of the CIA away from the Sicilian, Turkish, Mexican, Southeast Asian connections. This is what the battle is about. Now, the mafia and the CIA work together in more ways than one, more than just shooting Castro. And Giancana was important to this,
And this is why he had to be killed
again this week. One strategic move was made by four men from Cleveland who allegedly burglarized a Howard Hughes computerized control center at Romaine Street last spring. And they took with them, I believe they took evidence that Hughes is not alive. One document that was found on the floor by the guard that they dropped was admittedly flushed down the toilet, which is a funny way to protect a building that you're hired to protect. Now, J. Edgar Hoover was afraid to incorporate the mafia into the FBI and government, although he did it, and we know he did it. He was always afraid of blackmail. And this week, in order to secure that there'd be no blackmail, and in keeping with my predictions that mafia chiefs would be killed by the CIA, Sam Giancana was murdered in Chicago. He was to be a witness before Senator Church's committee on charges that the CIA used mafia hitmen and their members to do dirty work, such as killing Castro. But Giancana could blackmail them for more. He wasn't just killed because he was hired to kill Castro. He was hired because there would be links between Giancana and his Chicago associate, Jack Ruby, and the underworld and the use of Ruby to kill Lee Harvey Oswald. You remember when Martin Luther King was shot, Ramsey Clark, the attorney general, one of our great phony liberals, along with men like Eugene McCarthy, was the first person on the air to tell us it was a lone man, there was no conspiracy. And at that time, he didn't even know, have a suspect or know how many people had shot Martin Luther King. 7 years later, just 7 years now, as of this week, the news is coming out that there was a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King. And I've been trying to explain this on Dialogue Conspiracy the last 4 years. But in the same ilk as Ramsey Clark coming out with that announcement, we have Senator Church, who assured the American people the minute that Sam Giancana was killed that it had nothing to do with his future witness before the Senate committee investigating CIA. Now, why would Frank Church, the senator, make an announcement of this kind? How would he know the links of who killed Giancana or why not? The local police said he was not killed by the mafia. And the police know that their own guard walked away just minutes before Giancana was killed, just the way Jack Ruby was allowed to go down the ramp to murder Lee Harvey Oswald. And the mafia would kill Giancana. He was testifying against the mafia, but this time he was testifying against the Central Intelligence Agency, and that's a different story. Acting Committee Chairman John Tower of Texas from the Senate Committee investigating the CIA made a famous, what could be a famous quotation. He said he didn't think Giancana would have been a particularly valuable witness. Well, Giancana was earning $1 million a year at one time. He held extensive gambling interests in Cuba under Batista. The news item this evening is the New York Daily News had an article about Paul Mescal, the millions of dollars that were involved in the syndicate there, the gambling interests in Cuba. He held these interests under Batista when Frank Sturgis of Watergate fame was running gaming tables for Batista. And Giancana knew all these people, as I say, Frank Sturgis and Jack Ruby. And he was killed before he could testify before the committee. Now, that only leaves Mr. Rosselli, a major employee of the CIA. The two top men were Giancana and Rosselli. That leaves Rosselli, the CIA partner, to Giancana to testify before the Senate committee. Robert Mayhew has received immunity, and no charges will be leveled against him for any possible links of these men as hitmen. But after Giancana was murdered, you can be sure that Rosselli isn't going to tell much about the links of the CIA and organized crime. The CIA destroys its records, and we'll go into that in a minute, but it also destroys its witnesses. And it's much less better to let people, it's better for them to suspect and guess than to find written notes or documents or living witnesses to testify on how they were used. So you get back again to a full cycle of killing an important witness from Chicago, Illinois, keeping the John Kennedy assassination eventually to a very low-level hitman and erasing those people who could blackmail the government and tell the story of the murderous links through the killing of Martin Luther King, the use of James Ray transporting him around, use of Jack Ruby, Sirhan at the racetracks. By killing these very important links, the government eventually may settle with a hitman, or maybe not even that much, but Giancano was important to these conspiracies. Now, the murder of Dorothy Hunt, the sabotage of her plane in December 72, was very important to the Watergate story. There wasn't enough money to buy the witnesses' silence. But G. Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt and James McCord and all the team got a very quick visual message when a United Airlines blows up and Dorothy Hunt, working with the CIA 21 years, very high up in the CIA, is murdered. This is the kind of silence that you don't have to spend $1 million for. You teach it visually, and one murder teaches any future witnesses what to testify or what not testify and what happens before or after you're caught, and they will then keep quiet. Jack Ruby had said, "Take me out of the jail and I'll tell you about the conspiracy to kill John Kennedy." He pleaded with Gerald Ford. He said he would never be alive. They wouldn't see him again. Gerald Ford left the room. Jack Ruby was killed. And that is one of the reasons James McCord was afraid to go to jail. He said, "I'll be killed in jail. I know how these things are done." And the men keep quiet, and the conspiracies are locked up by judges, like of a Marin County shootout. And at every level, if it can't be done with paying somebody off, it's done with murders, and Giancano's murder, as I say, is important. Well, there will be more murders to come, the gangland murders, because, as I say, the Howard Hughes Empire was robbed June 5th, 1974, and a man, Woolbright, his name from St. Louis, was charged with that. He was active in gang wars, and he said that he was serving as an intermediary for the burglary, that there was valuable information in the safe. Now, there was more in that safe than the story of the CIA links to the submarine that surfaced. So you can expect that the Howard Hughes links to the CIA and the particular assassinations will see a large amount of murder coming down, and we'll be seeing that for a long time to come. Another man was murdered this week who's an important link to the Hughes CIA connections and to government mishandling of funds or contracts. His name has been in the news the last 2 weeks. His name is General Stalin, S-T-E-H-L-I-N. General Paul Stalin, former French, I'm reading this from today's news, former French Air Force Chief of Staff, recently revealed to have been on the payroll of the Northrop Corporation, died yesterday, that's June 22nd, from injuries suffered when he was run over by a bus June the 7th. Now, 15 days after the scandal broke of the Northrop deal and the funds that were transferred to him because he was pushing American contracts for French weapons, this man was hit by a bus. It said his wife has consistently denied that the bus accident was a suicide attempt or any way connected with the revelations that the U.S. Senate subcommittee that he had been Northrop's pay since shortly after he quit his post of chief of staff in 1964. He received $5,000 in 64, $6,000 in 68, and then $7,500 in 74, and he was promoting airplane contracts, Northrop's YF-17 and General Dynamics F-16, and claiming they were superior to the French Mirage until the Americans got these huge contracts. And the news that broke last week is that the Hughes Aircraft Company said that Paul Stalin, a member of the French Parliament, was linked to them and is a consultant for one of its subsidiaries. He worked for the Hughes Aircraft International Service Company of Delaware. So here again, you have the Hughes persons, one of their agents involved, high up in French government, receiving money from Americans, and when he's about to be called as a witness, when there's mishandling of data to praise one airplane manufacturer over another, and the man that's doing it is getting these huge amount of personal fees, he gets hit by a bus, and 15 days later, he's dead, and that's the end of General Stalin. When the report first came out, was leaked to the French press about Stalin, he quickly was retired from the government, from the active Air Force Reserve. He was forced to resign from the parliament, and then hit by a bus, and he died yesterday. So Sam Giancano is one kind of a person, organized crime that was used by the CIA, and he's dead. And then we have a member of the French Parliament, a high-up general, and he's hit by a bus, and he's dead just when he's about to testify. And the kind of thing goes on and on. The result of the apathy of the last 11 years of people into the assassinations of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and many, many more that I could go on, I think, and I have files, I believe, goes into the hundreds, is that we're getting a continuous murdering of private citizens from all walks of life, political candidates, people like Popeye Jackson from the United Prisoners Union to the shooting of George Wallace or the killing of Murray Chotiner, lifelong friend of Richard Nixon, or Karen Silkwood on the plutonium scandal that she was linking. All of these can be solved. They have the same sticky fingers of domestic Central Intelligence Agency. And given an opportunity to testify in Washington, I would try to show that there is a continuity to these murders and how it's linked. Now, secondly, along with this is the continuous destruction of evidence because these murder stories are breaking so fast and lawsuits are coming. And the third danger is the creation of new laws so that no person can handle documents without being charged with treason. There'll be no more Pentagon Papers, no more Watergate exposures. So that as all these various lawsuits on these murders are taking place and people are becoming aware, there is the destruction of evidence. The Washington Post ran a large story this week by William Colby. I'm going to read it to you. It's dated June 22, 1975, and it said, "Routine step. The CIA destroyed their misdeed records. The Central Intelligence Agency conducted a hurried cursory check of CIA misdeeds in the wake of Watergate, failed to tell the White House of its findings, destroyed its records." Mr. Colby said that Richard Helms before him destroyed records up until January 73, and then when he came in, he destroyed various records and drug testing programs among them. Now, this is interesting. He said it embarrassed him to have these things around. He said what he destroyed, the report included a section on assassination plots and schemes. The other portion, it was a rehash of old Inspector General's reports to the CIA, and then they destroyed the testing of LSD and the controversial programs of LSD. Now, I think it's very important that he admits that he destroyed the assassination records and the drug programs, because the two things that I've screamed about in lectures at colleges or the Assassination Bureau conference in Boston or in Los Angeles, wherever I speak, are the links of mind control, behavior modification, psychosurgery, hypnosis to the general population, prisoners in particular, and suspects in some various crimes, and particularly the Patsies involved in political assassinations. I think the two big stories, if I were to confine my files to the two biggest stories in the last 11 years of the political research, of course, the center is the political assassinations of the leaders, and the second is the use of mind control to affect the population in various techniques. This is an area where I have been at variance with Mark Lane. He doesn't see the difference between political assassinations, the links between them, and the importance of the use of mind control. And I believe that the documents on mind control were more important than the Abraham Zapruder film. And it's unfortunate that Mr. Colby has destroyed from the CIA their records on mind control. There was an article today, Associated Press article in the paper today, and last week about a medical convention in Minneapolis. And the gentleman who was quoted is from Mount Vernon, New York. He's talking about Mount Vernon, New York. But he's from Massachusetts in the same area, Mount Holyoke Hospital, where Dr. Delgado works in Yale. And I've talked about Delgado's use of electrode and implants and political assassinations. But this sociologist gave a paper on how to have a crime-free society, and I'm quoting it because this was a medical journal, and this is something that people who listen to Dialogue Conspiracy regularly know that I've been harping on. This sociologist told a group of people at Minneapolis that the United States could be virtually crime-free by the year 2000. And that's not very long from now, 30 years from now. He said, "We are so effective in manipulative medical and technical techniques that criminal behavior can be controlled." This is Robert Moran, professor of Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. Moran said that hospitals and prisons can blur into one institution. Now, this is exactly what I said happened in Nazi Germany and is happening in America. He said the physically and the criminally ill will be medically treated together. society would have to allow medical intervention to treat a criminal who would not be judged from a moral or guilt point, but as someone who's defective and who needs treatment. He said it would be easy for a coercive government to impose treatment for those who didn't cooperate. Mr. Moran went on to say that crime is being listed as an illness anyway and a threat to society, and those who refuse to follow the public health rules, what he said is that we have public health rules to get vaccinated against a contagious disease, and that people that are considered criminals are a threat to society and should be following mandatory public health rules. This Dr. Moran has predicted an early warning screening system to weed out potential criminals. Now, this isn't people who've done crimes. This is an early system. And this is what the UCLA School to Study Violence was wanting to do and is probably still doing if it isn't thoroughly checked, to weed out potential criminals, much like public health screens people with undetected diseases. And those that are violent prone or crime prone would theoretically be treated, are you ready? They'll be treated by implanting electronic devices in the brain that could be used to monitor his movements. Such electronic monitoring from a central security center would guarantee total compliance of a person on probation or in community correction programs. Now, I've maintained for the last 2 years that 25 million transponders have been made. I think the amount is 25 million to surgically implant into people's heads to control their emotions, their feelings, the geographic areas, and that the satellites, if they're not up there already, and I believe they are already up there to receive these messages, are being tested. And he goes on to say that many cities have big brothers watching television surveillance, and he further says that we have anti-hijacking airport screening devices where people give up their right to privacy in favor of safety. Without security, there is no freedom, the sociologist said, and I suspect we'll be all too willing to make that swap. Without security, there is no freedom. Now, these people who are doing these electrode implants are directly linked to the past political assassinations, to the hypnosis, the mind control that is going on in the country, and these hospitals should be checked. They're not checked. There's a two-year moratorium. The Congress had a two-year moratorium on psychosurgery this year, on electrode implants. But we're not getting any public reports or documents or studies of who had the electrodes in them. Did Mr. Wayne Chastain, who shot Mrs. Martin Luther King, does he get electronically or radio control to go down and shoot her when she's playing the organ in church? Did Loris Kwong, who shot at KGO, who said he was being controlled, did he have an electrode in his head? Can that body be brought up in autopsy, be done? I said it should have been done a long time ago. And I think it's important to know that Mr. Colby is sitting back very smug and announcing that he did destroy sections on the LSD and the government behavior modification programs that the CIA was doing, and that he did destroy sections of the assassination plots. And I think that the problem now is that new laws, as I say, are coming out, the new crime bill that they're trying to push through, so that you can't get the official documents that exist. It would be treason to get a hold of these official documents. And this crime bill is written by Richard Nixon. It's being pushed by John McClellan and Mr. Mansfield, Mike Mansfield, and you, Scott. It'll take away our civil liberties, and all newsmen who write about this kind of thing that would embarrass the government could be sent to jail or a $10,000 fine. Any allegations are made by word of mouth. The government can say you have no documentation to prove it. It's only theories. And then if you prove it, you're fined and put in prison if you take the documents out of the agencies. I think the discussion of the sociologist in Minneapolis on the electrode implants is terribly important because they've been planning them for 20 years. They've been testing them for 20 years, but they're getting you ready for them. And that is why these shootouts allowed by the CIA and the FBI to take place up at Marin County happen. These violences to terrorize you, to terrorize people on the streets, and to keep this fear going until you are willing to have transponders put into the heads of men before they're on parole are mental patients and control their emotions. I think that another important thing when we talk about the CIA, we talk about Howard Hughes, they're just one, and we talk about the Mormon Mafia. How can Mormons, which is a religion or supposed to be a religion, be a mafia when you understand the traditional name of the mafia? And I just brought in briefly, I don't have time to go into it, but some of you may do some more research on this. There's an article, June 7th, 1975, about the Mormon research effort, the linking of people's names and genealogies that's kept in a large vault in Salt Lake City. It was in the San Jose Mercury, June 7th, 1975. And the first information about these huge vaults was in Time Magazine, August 22nd, 1969. And you know that every listening person, here's Dialogue Conspiracy, or any single person in the United States should be made aware that your name, your genealogy, when you were born, what you weighed, is locked up inside a vault and microfilm in a canyon in Utah, in Salt Lake City. There's these huge, giant cliffs that keeps on microfilm information about families of every country in the world that goes back six generations farther than that to the year almost 600. In 1969, Time Magazine said there were 250 microfilm reading machines in this canyon that employs 550 people, spends $5 million a year filming records of 17 countries, producing 400 feet of microfilm every month. And there was a conference where Utah's Republican Senator Wallace Bennett, who calls himself a Mormon, said that there should be a worldwide record bank and vital statistics of all nations. That's Time Magazine, August 22, 1969. And this recent article in June came out and said that thanks to the computer age and 35 years of aggressive pursuit of genealogical records, the Mormon Church has collected more than 30 million volumes of genealogical material, vast archives in a 28-story building. It draws more than 250,000 people there into these vaults each year. The responsibility for tracing these names goes back to a handful of people who are spending millions of dollars hunting down the genealogy of persons unbeknownst to you in the vaults in Utah. At present, I'm reading this article, nearly 1 million microfilm rolls in the collection are growing at a rate of 4,000 rolls a month. They're under 700 feet of granite, large steel doors. The construction started in 61. It ended in 65. The temperature and humidity is carefully controlled. In the event of a nuclear blast, the doors are automatically sealed. They can photograph 100 years of the London Times in less than two drawers of storage space, and every day in more than 20 countries around the world, operators of 70 microfilm cameras are at work collecting the genealogy of every person in this globe that they can get. The camera film, such as records of parish registers, the census rolls of every country, wills, deeds, and last year for the first time the cameras were in Taiwan. There's 35 years of microfilming have given the library an almost complete record of certain available documents in Scotland, Hungary, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Fiji, France. There's six cameras working in France. There's 13 in the United States. The Salt Lake City Library has 170 branches. Now, this is important. There's 230 microfilm projection machines on the library's main floor, and this may be the most super data bank that the CIA has combined behind the smokescreen of genealogy of the Mormons, because it was Mr. Bennett's son's office that hired E. Howard Hunt and James McCord for the entry into the Watergate. They used to meet in those offices. If Hughes and CIA are one, and if this vast Mormon library contains the genealogy of all of us, every single person, what is this to be used for, and shouldn't it be examined? If the Hughes Corporation won't produce Howard Hughes, he's run by what you call the Mormon Mafia, and they're keeping record of us and our families. This may be the most super data bank, and we want to know about it. If you're more interested in the data bank, I'll do more on it next week because our time is running out. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy, and take care, and we hope there aren't too many assassinations of witnesses during this next week.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB FM in Carmel, California.